Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm, a sustainable pasture-based dairy farm. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 169 of The Morning After. I am your host, Sari Kamen.
And I'm Leslie Stockton. Today, we have Sarah Moulton as a guest.
Woohoo!
So excited. But first, food news.
Yes, food news indeed. All right. First up, KFC Australia.
Oh, no Japan this week.
No, actually, no Japan.
Okay.
So KFC Australia made a little boo-boo. They had a new ad campaign for a hot and spicy, I don't know, chicken campaign, hot and spicy. So their tweet, to promote the hot and spicy chicken, they launched a little ad campaign with a tweet involving a photograph of a woman and a man sitting next to each other on a couch. Sounds fine so far, except that the man's, let's say, lower nether region is pixelated, and then the woman is sitting next to the man on the couch, reaching her hand towards said pixelated region. And the tweet says, "Warning, hashtag not suitable for work or not, you know, safe, NSFW, something hot and spicy is coming soon, ... So, so not surprisingly, people who read the tweet were like, a hand job? Like, what are you doing, KFC?
KFC, like, reach around?
Yeah, exactly. And, like, my favorite response is, KFC, if you are experiencing hot and spicy sensations in your genitals, I recommend you speak to a doctor. So many people were very confused, like, what is the hot and spicy sensation that we're talking about? Is it the chicken? Is it jerk chicken? Like, there was just so many people who were confused.
Oh my God, what if it is jerk chicken? That is so brilliant.
It is brilliant, but it wasn't. It was just hot and spicy. So KFC Australia, like, removed the tweet and apologized. They wrote, "We're very sorry for our earlier tweet. We didn't mean to offend, and removed it when we realized we'd made an error in judgment."
What
did you expect? I mean, like, it's like a girl reaching towards a pixelated specific reason saying hashtag NSFW, hot and spicy.
Listen, with the offensive stuff that I see on a daily basis, that is really not that bad.
It's not that bad. It's just like, how do people sit together in a room and be like, this is gonna not be offensive?
Plus, it's Australia. They That's have true. A different brand of humor.
They do. They do. I mean, I don't know if they do. They just get away with it a little more. But they didn't get away with this. Okay, moving on. A London restaurant developed a 3-course pop-up brunch for dogs.
No, stop
yes,
it.
Yes, mm-hmm. They did. The restaurant is called Bluebird. They launched a quotations, Bites and Bones pop-up this month with a 3-course puppy-centric brunch menu. And quote, they're saying, "Bring your beloved pet pooch to our courtyard and treat them to a real Michelin star style doggy dining experience." So the menu, it's actually a separate menu for the dogs because they can read. So to start, there is venison sausage, beefy brown rice served with a beef broth. I'm kind of annoyed they didn't use the word consommé.
Oh.
They really missed an opportunity. The main course is chicken and lamb and, in quotes, Barkenberg loaf. I don't know what that is. And the dessert is a sweet potato and peanut butter macaroon with a doggy gelato filling. That sounds pretty good.
So do the dog owners sit down and have their own brunch as well?
Unclear.
Yeah, that's what I'm... Are you just going to sit there and watch your dog eat a 3-course meal? That's
possibly
my question.
I don't know. If it was, would you bring your dog?
Would you do that?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
I would 100% do that.
You would sit there and watch your dog eat a 3-course meal?
I would. I love my dog so much. It would make me so happy to do that.
Don't you think they would at least offer beverages?
I would love a drink. I would love a cocktail.
Like a bloody or something.
A bloody would make
Help
the experience
me
extremely...
Out.
Yeah, okay. Would you do that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now that we've decided, that's totally reasonable and not at all ridiculous.
As long as bevies are involved.
That's what's up. My dog can eat Michelin food and I would watch. Not even be jealous.
Oh, Instagram, everything. I would be that person for sure.
Me too. Yeah. Okay.
All right. High five.
Yeah, high five. Okay. Lastly, you can now pay your taxes at 7-Eleven. Just would you not?
I don't know if 7-Eleven can take care of all my 1099 action.
That's a good point. Do you want a little more information?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know tax season. Well, it's not over because I think you could pay until the 18th.
Really?
This year. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So you have till tomorrow. David's nodding yes. Have you paid your taxes, David? He's saying yes. But if you haven't, it's not too late because there are 34 7-Elevens. No, just kidding. There's 34 states with 7-Elevens where you can go into the 7-Eleven and pay your taxes in cash.
No.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
For a small fee, they've partnered up with the IRS because clearly America does not have their shit together.
Well, for
like in such an extreme way that this is what we've come to.
Don't get me started on having to pay a fee to pay your damn taxes.
Dude, it's 7-Eleven. Like, if you can't get your shit together to the point where you have to, like, seek out a 7-Eleven, like, you deserve to pay a fee.
Okay, so your tax is already done and you're filing at the 7-Eleven?
I don't know, man.
I don't know either.
I hope there's a Slurpee involved. Like, that's... Do you get a free Slurpee if you pay your taxes at 7-Eleven? Like, that's what I want
to
know.
Do I get to walk out with a Frito pie, like, in the bag?
I hope so.
Please.
Once again, I think we've come to the conclusion if bevvies are involved, it's all good.
Yes, it's so true.
Okay.
Bevvies make it better.
We're going to take a break. We're going to be back with the incredible Sarah Moulton.
Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm. Consider Bardwell Farm is a sustainable pasture-based dairy farm, making award-winning raw cow and goat's milk cheeses in a not-too-far corner of Vermont. For Consider Bardwell, sustainability means caring for the land, raising their animals well, reducing waste, and helping their community, all in the name of happy animals and people and delicious cheeses. Consider Bardwell Farm is proud to support Heritage Radio Network as part of their food and farming community and a proud sponsor of all good conversations had over great cheese. Find them at your local cheese counter, at New York City Green Markets, and online at considerbardwellfarm.com.
Sarah Moulton is a cookbook author, a television host, a recipe writer, a chef, and co-founder of the New York Women's Culinary Alliance. She was the chef of the executive dining room at Gourmet for 20 years, until it ceased publication in 2009. Sarah is well known for being a protege of Julia Child, a relationship that began when she worked on Julia Child and More Company on PBS. Her latest cookbook, Home Cooking 101, was recently released in 2016. Welcome to the show, Sarah Moulton.
Why, thank you, lady.
Oh, hello!
So excited to have you.
Well, I'm excited to be on.
So earlier today, I was watching a clip of Cooking Live. You were making butter sauces with Julia Child.
No big deal.
No big deal, whatever. and it made me think, I have to know, what was it like to be her protege?
Well, fantastic, as you can imagine.
I can't.
I can't.
But 'cause she was just... so wonderful. She was the funniest person, one of the funniest people I ever met, because she was so refreshingly honest. It was ridiculous. And she was just very thoughtful, very hardworking, you know, taught me a lot, but also wanted to know what I thought and who I was. And she was that way with everyone. But, you know, back to what you started saying, having her on my show made me a nervous wreck. Because, you know, here is this grand dame of absolutely everything that matters to me on my show. So that was difficult. I mean, although she was lovely, of course, as always.
Your show was, Cooking Live was one of my favorite shows.
Oh, thank you. It was one of my favorite, too, I have to say.
It's kind of like how we feel having you on our show now, Sarah.
I know.
Sarah, so how do you think, like, since the time that, you know, Julia Child was, like, one of the original actual cooking TV stars, how did Julia influence and then just change the course of what American cooking is today, do you think?
Well, I mean, when she came on the scene, which was in the 60s, women had, quote-unquote, been liberated by frozen food. I think the idea was that it was cool not to have to cook, you know, because women were coming into the workforce and didn't want to cook as much. And so, whoa, just throw in the TV dinner, you know, which, of course, we know was really gross. And so Julia comes on the scene, having spent all this time in France, saying, no. You need to cook, and cooking is fun, which is, a matter of fact, something she used to say when we worked with her and also at her dinner parties, because we'd all go cook at her house for her dinner parties with her. It was fun. I mean, and she would stop in the middle of everything when we were prepping and say, aren't we having so much fun? So I think that's what she did. You know, it's really interesting when executives at TV stations say, you know, it's no longer about education, it's about entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that's what we really care about, regardless whether it's food or whatever it is. But when you think about it, nobody combined entertainment and education better than Julia Child. She was both.
I'm so glad you mentioned that point, because you were one of the pioneers of the Food Network, along with Emeril and Mario Batali. And I was just wondering, how do you feel about the way food television has changed and evolved throughout the years?
Well, you know, I don't. Let me just say this. When I watch TV, when I watch food TV, I'd like to learn something. But having said that, you really, even when I don't watch competition shows, which is what mostly it is, mm-hmm. because they make me nervous.
Me too.
You know, it's like watching my kid in the kindergarten play. You know, I worry for whoever's cooking. Are they going to win, you know? And I feel terrible when they don't. It just seems like a very sort of mean environment. And to me, food is about sharing, not about competing. But just as the American public loves reality shows, they love cooking reality shows, too.
Maybe so, even more so.
Heck with me. And having said that, if I should happen to end up watching one, which I don't do for very long, as I said, because it makes me a nervous wreck, I always learn something. You know, you can't help but learn something. But me, if I'm going to watch food TV, and I don't watch much TV, period, because I just don't have any time, but if I did, I'd want to learn something. And I don't think you learn as much from those competition shows.
Sure. I mean, I think there's so many pros and cons to having so much exposure to cooking, like whether it's on TV, whether it is a reality competition show or not. So, I mean, Sarah, in your opinion, is it a good thing or like not such a good thing that, you know, like you said, we're learning a little bit about cooking by watching these shows, or does it make us just watch TV more and cook less?
Well, that is the question mm-hmm. of the century. Are we cooking more? And actually, I tell you, I think there's one segment of the population that's cooking more. And you two, I don't know how old you are, but may fit into that.
I'm 18.
Okay.
I'm
young
slightly older at 23.
I'm just kidding. I'm not 18 at all.
The Food Network. Yeah, who were watching the Food Network when they were kids. You know, when they were, you know, 1 and 2 and 5 and 7 and 9, I think they've grown up cooking. I think they learned back then how to cook because there's, you know, so many generations of mothers who didn't cook anymore, and there was no more sort of teaching children how to cook because it wasn't considered necessary or whatever. So I think a lot of young kids did learn how to cook who are now grown-ups, you know, in their 20s and 30s, did learn how to cook from the Food Network. I'll tell you one thing, whether people are actually, besides that comment right there, whether everybody else is actually cooking who watches food TV 24/7, I don't know, but they sure as heck know the language.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started, which was on April 2nd, 1996, to be exact, you know, we would talk about fun new ingredients or new cooking tools like panko breadcrumbs, woo, you know,
yeah.
Chipotles and adobo, oh my God, you know, and it was big news. Now, you know, like because I'm on book tour or I'm just about to go on book tour, when I go do demos at these cookware shops, you know, I have to really work hard to impress people because they speak the language. They know the buzzwords, you know, both the ingredients and the tools and the things they're supposed to know. Again, does that translate into people actually cooking? I'm not sure, but I sort of feel like I think more people are cooking. I maybe just because I want to believe that.
But the experience from your point of view of like hearing people who show up and they know, like you said, the buzzwords, is that frustrating or is that exciting? Is it like not as interesting if we all kind of speak the same language at this point?
Oh, no, I think it's wonderful. Okay. I think it's really great as long as they're not like, tell me something new, yawn. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, when I was, here's something absolutely astonishing. When I graduated from the Culinary Institute of America, which is in 1977, but anyway, we only used one salt. We used table salt.
Wow.
And
oh,
that's at the Harvard of cooking school, as Julia called it. I mean, can you imagine?
No diamond crystal, huh?
No. And so that's how much things have evolved. And, you know, when Julia was first on TV, she was like, please go talk to your grocer and tell him you need shallots, you need leeks. You know, create a demand, and then they will get it for you. Now, just think about what you can even get at plain old supermarkets, let alone farmers markets. It's a very exciting time to be cooking, mm-hmm. and I think the more that we all talk about it, the better.
Yeah, yeah. Sarah, what inspired you to create the Women's Culinary Alliance?
Well, it was sort of a negative. I had been in Boston after I graduated from cooking school. I worked in restaurants there for 5 years. And we sort of noticed, a bunch of us, because a whole bunch of us would work with Julia on the show and for fundraisers and stuff. We were all women. And we sort of noticed that there were male organizations, chef organizations, but there was none for women. So we formed a group in Boston called the Boston Women's Culinary Guild. It is now, I think, the New England Culinary Guild. It's boys and girls. It's not just girls anymore. But it was sort of somewhat empowering. And so when I moved to New York in 1981, I encountered even more problems here than I did in Boston in terms of getting a job. This is when I was working in restaurants. So I came to New York in 81 because my husband dragged me here. We weren't married yet, but he moved here. And I wanted to get a job working for a great chef, because from the moment I graduated from the CIA till the moment I came to New York City, I was in over my head. I'd been hired as a sous chef, and then I was a chef. And I'm not saying I didn't do okay. I did just fine. But I was leading the ship, or whatever it is, whatever the term is. But anyway, now I wanted to go and learn from some great master. So I went to every great restaurant in New York, and Julia gave me introductions, so I was in very good shape, one would think. But nobody would hire me. And why wouldn't they hire me? Because I was a woman. Because all of these restaurants were, at the helm was usually a European male, usually French. And they didn't want have anything to do with any woman in their kitchen or in their restaurant working. So that was sort of, I'm not going to say the last straw, but made me think, geez, we need to do the same thing here as we did in Boston. So I got together with a friend of mine. I did end up getting a job, but it was for a woman chef. And actually, she didn't want to hire me either because she was the queen bee. But I wore her down. She had to hire me. And at any rate, but her chef de cuisine, I was hired as the chef tournant, the substitute cook. But her chef de cuisine was a guy named Guy Rouge, very talented chef. And his wife, Mariah, who was American, worked at Gourmet Magazine. And she and I became friends, great friends, and I told her about this problem, and she agreed with me it was a problem. And so she and I teamed up, and then eventually with a bunch of people from Gourmet Magazine, formed this group that's now still going, Great Guns, all these many years later. So it was very exciting, but that's what motivated us is, you know, let's just have our own group. And the point of the Women's Culinary Alliance is it's educational and it's networking. We do some charitable things, but it's really focused on the members, and we pride ourselves on anybody out of cooking school, as long as you work quote-unquote full-time, which I think we define as 35 hours per week, or maybe even 30 because, you know, with catering and stuff, there's on-seasons and off-seasons. But anybody who works that many hours in the food industry is welcome to join. You also have to live in the tri-state area, and you also have to be active. But that's what motivated me.
So on that same on that same vein, when I came to New York to cook in 2003, it wasn't so much, just to give you some comparison about how it has changed over the years, getting a job wasn't hard, because finding good line cooks is very difficult for restaurants these days. It's upward mobility once a woman gets onto the hotline, because you see guys come into the restaurant, you know, blaze past garmanger, blaze past hot apps, and they're all of a sudden they're entremets or meat roast, and you're stuck on hot apps, and you're like, what? Wait, hold on, you know?
Yeah.
So that's it's a terrible. Different game. Yeah.
Do you think that things have improved, Sarah, in terms of like the gender issue?
Better. They're just not best.
Yeah.
You know, every year I work on this event, Share, which is a fundraiser in the fall.
We love Share.
Yeah.
Have you guys done that?
Yeah. Well, we've had guests on the show.
Yeah, it's
several
a wonderful
years in a row
event.
For Share. It is a great event.
I always sign up for. You know, our Deb, what's her name from? Pearl Oyster Bar.
Oh, yeah. The good lobster rolls.
They're the most popular booth because they've got lobster
the
rolls.
The best lobster rolls.
Everyone loves the lobster
rolls. Yeah, we have lines around the block. Mm-hmm. And I just love it because it's also like being what I imagine being a grandmother is going to be like. My kids aren't ready yet, but, you know, where you can sort of borrow the kid and sort of cuddle it and then give it back, you know. So I get to be the quote-unquote celebrity sous chef for the evening and stuff lobster rolls, but do them to the excellent fashion that's required because it's such a great restaurant, and then I get to leave. You know, it's wonderful. But when I talk to them about it, you know, the women chefs who are there, and I'm like, how are things going? And they're like, well, you know, on this very issue of how are women doing in the city. For one thing, what's great is there are women chefs, and we know who some of them are, and some of them get press. But the bad news is, apparently, according to my friends, they don't get the same deals, they don't get the same offers about new restaurants, and they don't get the same press.
Why is that?
It's so lopsided.
Yeah, it really is.
Is it still a problem at this day and age? I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
No, it really doesn't. But then again, you say, whatever it is, women are still making 76 cents on the dollar, you know, for every dollar a man makes in every
and that's optimistic.
Facet of the economy. I guess there's nothing different, you know?
Yeah.
Especially in highly competitive, you know, boys club fields.
Yes, true. True that. But I do think things are better. And the fact that there are women chefs who probably hire other women, that's great.
Honestly, that's what it's going to take.
Yeah, I think
more
so.
More women in positions of power hiring more women and bringing them up.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it is. So, you know, sisters out there, take note.
Yep.
Yeah. So I recently read My Kitchen Year by Ruth Reichel, and it was just... It was so heartbreaking to read what her life was initially like after the closing of Gourmet. And I'd love to hear how it affected you personally and just, you know, what the culture actually really felt like once the magazine shut down, because you were there for 20 years.
25. It was definitely a hole. I'll tell you that. We all were sort of lost because we really, I mean, I worked on the advertising side. You know, Ruth was editorial. And, but so I had probably a better idea that it was coming than she did.
Sounds like it.
Even though she was the editor in chief. But I'm on the edit. What I did in the beginning, first 4 years, I worked in the test kitchen. And then the remaining 21, I was chef of the executive dining room. And what that grand title meant was I ran the executive dining room. We entertained clients, guests. And my job was to make the magazine come alive. And it was really fun, you know, back to our conversation about being a chef in a restaurant, because I only had 16 seats and no food cost. So I could make really excellent food, and I had to keep, you know, doing new things from the magazine, so it kept things really fresh, because the magazine changed every month. So it was a great learning thing for me, too, but we knew that things were bad because the advertisers, because we worked on advertorials and other things with the advertisers, they wouldn't even pick up the phone.
Oh, man.
That's how bad it was after 2008. And we just, in 2007, I'd finally gotten the money and finally done the first season of my public television show, Sarah's Weeknight Meals, And then 2008 happened, and same thing. We couldn't get any advertisers on the phone, and we were more concerned about getting advertising for the magazine than money for my show. And it just was so obvious that things were really bad. So I wasn't surprised when it happened, but it was really sad. I had a wonderful world over there. I had my own little world. I had a fantastic sous chef. And this other woman who did prep for us, and we'd been together for many years, and we just had so much fun every day, you know? So it was, yeah, it was bad. I mean, the real story behind it, why Gourmet survived and Bon Appetit didn't, is, do we have time for this?
Absolutely. Yes.
I'll try to say it real quickly.
No, 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 we're not in a rush.
I came to understand, because I talked to a lot of different people, it was a perfect storm in that we'd gone through a bunch of publishers and we'd been losing sales reps. I mean, I know about the business side of Gourmet, but really, at the end of the day, here's what happened. Bon Appetit, when Condé Nast bought it, had a much larger subscription base than Gourmet, but they had a much lower demographic, meaning not as wealthy people. And Condé Nast wanted the wealthy demographic. And Gourmet had that, but at a lower subscription base. And over the years that Bon Appetit was owned by Condé Nast, that demographic got higher and higher, meaning more, you know, it went up and up and up and up till they had the same wealthy subscribers as they did for Gourmet. And so at the end of the day, when they had to pick one, who were they going to pick? The one with a larger subscription base. Mm-hmm. So that's really what happened.
Yeah, there's definitely in the absence of Gourmet. I feel it. There's really nothing out there right now that quite captures the understated elegance of Gourmet.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
Miss it.
I know. I've got them all. You can come over to my house anytime. I got them all.
Might take you up on that.
Yeah.
So I would love to talk about your book, Home Cooking 101. The first thing I want to say that I've noticed about it, the first thing I picked up on is it's very instructional. You list out like all black pepper is freshly ground. All butter is unsalted. Bay leaves come from Turkey, you know, just in case there's any confusion, this is what it is. And, you know, it's technique driven, but not technique heavy, if that makes any sense. And it's just not a list of recipes that people can just follow by the letter. It's empowering. Writing it.
I approve of all of those comments.
It's a great book. I think it's a book version of, you know, those meals in a box, but better because there's much less waste.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you feel that way. It was a very intense book to write. It's my fourth book, and on all my other books, I had a partner who came to my house and, you know, I would give her the recipe and she'd cook it and, you know, and then we'd taste it and we'd fix it. But this one, I was on my own. I did have two wonderful young women interns from the ICC, International Culinary Center. But other than that, it was sheer hell. It was intense. And because there was so much writing, and I'm not a writer. My husband is. So he was very involved also. But that was really stressful. And also, I had this editor, the woman who really pushed me to do it, who's actually left me midway. I've always been an orphan on every book I've done. Leah McLaughlin, who's now at Condé Nast. Isn't that interesting? But anyway, Leah was really pushing me. She said, this has got to be really a big book. This has got to be an important book. You've got to make sure there's something different about it. And I think really because of Leah, I worked a lot harder. I'm not that I'm a slouch here. I don't eat bonbons, but I really tried harder and thought harder and more about it and tried to incorporate. It's a very personal book, although it's a general, it's supposed to be a teaching manual for home cooks, but it's a very personal book in that I cashed in on all of the stuff I've learned over 40 years. It will be 40 years next year since I graduated from the Culinary Institute of America at the age of 12. But any rate, you know,
I'm still 18.
So I hope it's all in there, and I think it is. And some of it's random, like some of the desserts. I mean, who really needs to make a French apple tart? But I just thought it's fun to have some aspirational things, you know, and
of course,
little tiny tricks that I learned that I wanted other people to be able to do. And because Oxmoor was willing to have all this photography where we could really show it, I thought, okay, let's do this. And I'm going to be personal, and I'm going to be random sometimes, although there's really a lot of very good general information in there.
Well, the art in your book is gorgeous. The photographs, I think it's wonderful. What part, you know, everyone's talking about how no one has any time anymore to cook or, you know, to even just get breakfast in their bellies before they go out the door. Were you really thinking about the home cook, the harried two-income household when you were putting this together?
Well, you know, I would say I focused on quick and easy, quick and easy, quick and easy much more in my last two cookbooks. That's really what they were, was just here's some recipes, here's some recipes, here's some recipes. This one is more in the category, not that there aren't some quick and easy recipes in this one, but this is more in the category of teach them how to fish.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell me I'm wrong. If someone is in a hurry, you know, if you're empowering them to say you can go home, look in your cupboards and your refrigerator and like throw something together, if you just use this book or you learn these techniques, you don't have to follow recipes to the letter, and you can just naturally pull dinner together in no time as you get more comfortable in the kitchen, this book can show you how.
Yeah, no, right. I say that's accurate.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most important things with this book is the first chapter, which includes, you know, just basic stuff like get to know your stove, get a good knife, mm-hmm. have a plan. And I'd say have a plan is very, very key to getting dinner on the table during the work week, because you can't just do it on the fly. I mean, yeah, you know, if you're a great chef and you can sort of wander through the farmer's market on the way home and grab this and that and then make up a menu, yeah, fine. But most of us are not like that. And, you know, if you're coming home from a long day at work, you're not really going to have any success going into a supermarket and putting together a menu. You need to do it on a weekend or when you have time, and plan the whole week. And I don't mean specific recipes. I just mean categories. Just make sure you have, you know, lots, you know, at least 5 proteins, at least 5 vegetables, at least 5 starches, or another 5 vegetables if you want to go with all vegetables. But get it in-house, and then it's so much easier to make dinner.
Yes.
Sarah, you have had such a prolific career thus far. It's still very much in its prime. But what would you say at this point are you most proud of?
Cooking Live.
Why is that?
Such a great show.
That live call-in show I did for 6 years, and then I did a taped show. I don't know. I just feel like that was a real challenge for me, you know, for those people who never watched it, because I thought at the time it was the under 5 or the over 80 set that watched it, and the over 80 set is not around anymore. The under 5 has grown up, and that's wonderful, but I felt like it was a real service. You know, I don't mean to sound like I'm a saint or anything, but it was a real service. You know, we all had, as a friend of mine described, it was like a town meeting every night. We had a topic, and we'd all weigh in on it, and we'd all learn together. And, you know, but for me, I had to study my brains out to be ready to do that show every night and take those questions and be the answer girl. And I just thought there was nothing like it before, and I don't think there's been anything like it since.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was very unique. I think it had its run. You know, when it was done, it was done. I would love to still be doing it, but I have been replaced by Google, that is for sure.
Oh, my goodness.
And if I did it now, there'd be all those snots, you know, on Google, you know.
Yeah.
You're checking up whether I was right or wrong and calling in and saying how wrong I was. so nobody needs it anymore, but I felt it really was useful at the time, and I felt like, for me, it was a huge education, and also I got a sense of this country and what people were cooking and what people were thinking and what their issues were. It was wonderful. And we had such a great team. We had so much fun every single night. It was something else.
Well, sort of to that point about getting a sense of food, what do you see as current food trends that are happening and any predictions for where we're moving?
Well, I love that we're getting, you know, when I went to college, I went to the University of Michigan, and I was, you know, that was in the 70s before I went to cooking school, and it was sort of the tail end of the Vietnam era and all that, and yeah, so I was a hippie. I went to the alternative part of the University of Michigan, and, you know, we did all those things you did as a hippie, and, you know, I lived in a house with three other women. We were vegetarians because we couldn't afford meat, but we also recycled. We did all these things that people are doing again, and I wish we'd really started in earnest back then doing what we're doing now for the sake of the planet. And so I'm thrilled to see it, and I hope that continues and gets all the noise that it's getting, you know, about farming and supporting farmers and not wasting food and starting from scratch. And I love it, and I think it will continue to go. What I'm hoping is there'll be a little more of a reality check about what's sustainable for the masses, not just what's sustainable for the environment. Mm-hmm. Now, this is more my hope, not what I necessarily think is going to happen, but I think there's been a little bit of a backlash against the whole locavore thing. I think it's wonderful on paper, but not everybody can afford to buy their groceries, you know, locally or from a farmer's market. You know, what's the wave of the future is more CSAs and more accessibility, like via, you know, using, they're not, whatever your, if you get a government subsidy to buy vegetables at the farmer's market, that is the way to go. I'm just hoping there will be more of that and less snobbery about where the food comes from and more reality about helping everybody to get good and nutritious food.
You hit the nail on the head. Let's take the snobbery out of it. Let's take the culture, like, you know, the class differences out of it.
Yeah.
And if we can just remove that pretense and be like, okay, we all need to eat a healthy diet. Let's figure this out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Please stay with us. We're going to be back with the
Absolutely.
Morning after quiz.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
With Sarah Moulton. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good.
All right, you are about to take the morning after quiz.
The dumbest quiz you'll ever take.
The most unimportant test of your life. I'm going to ask you three multiple choice questions about something you may or may know anything about. So, Sarah Moulton, you know all about being Sarah Moulton, but what do you know about the history of Moulton chocolate cake?
Get it, Moulton?
Get it.
I thought this was a multiple choice question.
It is. That was just the lead-in.
I think it was invented by
Sarah. That wasn't the quiz.
I could be wrong.
She probably knows a lot about it.
I know. You're going to hit every question. Okay, so question number one. In 1966, a cake titled Tunnel of Fudge won second place at the Pillsbury Bake Off. It was the first incarnation of the molten chocolate cake.
Ah.
And it was baked in a bundt pan.
Tunnel of fudge.
What did this pioneering baking contestant use for the gooey center? Was it A, instant pudding, B, chocolate ice cream, or C, dried frosting mix?
Oh, God. Really? Those are my choices?
Those are your choices.
One of them is true.
I'm going to go with A,
the pudding.
You would think so, but actually it was dry frosting mix. As it baked, it like liquefied, and you just cut into it.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, it does.
Wow.
I've never even had dry frosting
mix
before.
We know who this person is?
Oh, my gosh. I had her name. She was from Texas. I know that.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's a Texas
thing. Genius.
I'm from Texas, and that is a pretty Texas thing to do.
You don't sound very Texas.
Houston, you know.
Okay.
Second question. Who actually developed the molten chocolate cake as we know it today, individually baked and served warm? Was it Jean-Georges?
That's what I said.
Was it Michel Bras? Or was it Jacques Torres?
I still am going to go with A, because that was my gut reaction.
Jean-Georges claims he invented it, but Jacques Torres calls shenanigans on that claim.
Well, he would, and I love him. He's like a 5-year-old putt in a whatever age suit. That's wonderful.
But actually, it's Michel Bras. He called it a coulon, and he invented it in 1981 in Paris.
Wow. Okay.
This is the sort of stuff
I would have done on my live show.
Oh.
You can come join our live show anytime.
Anytime you want.
You are welcome.
We are in New York City. So Jean-Georges says, I pulled a half-baked cake, sponge out of the oven, and the middle was still gooey, and it was delicious. But Michel Bras, whose cake is actually not in the time and temperature danger zone, his is filled with a chocolate ganache, and that is what oozes out when you cut into it.
Nice. So.
Jean-Georges, if you're listening, which I'm sure you are, feel free to call in.
I'm not saying your cakes are unhealthy. I'm sorry.
You're okay.
Okay. So this next question is a little passe, but, I love questions like this. How many calories are in the molten chocolate cake with vanilla ice cream dessert at Chili's restaurant? Is it A, 740, B, 1,030, or C, 1,280?
I'm going to go with B.
You're right. You
that
got
was
it.
Lucky. But, my God, you're only supposed to eat, 2,000 calories a day, and you ate half of them in one dessert?
Yeah. What if,
terrible.
Exactly.
But I think it's totally fair if you eat two of those a day, and that's all you eat.
Right. Well, that's what Weight Watchers would let you do that these days.
That,
you know that.
And a multivitamin, I guess you're good to go.
Yeah. Wow.
That and a green juice. That's a good day.
Oh, my goodness. Sarah, you got one right, and that's pretty good.
It's really good.
Oh, good.
You're still very legit in
our
book.
Yeah.
Sarah, thank you so much for being on the show. It was an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you on.
Well, Sarah and Leslie, thank you so much. It's been fun talking with you.
Absolutely. And I know you said you're starting your book tour, so how can we find out where you'll be?
On my website, sarahmolton.com, you go and you'll see all events. It's easy to navigate on my website. You'll see where I'm going to be. I'm going to be in all the little tiny cities around the country.
What about the big cities?
Some of the big cities, but not so much.
Okay.
More the little guys.
Okay.
Because I'm working with this wonderful cookware company, Chantal. They're sponsoring my book tour, and so we're going to little mom-and-pop cookware shops.
Well, that sounds fun.
Sort of like cooking live.
That sounds great.
I'm going to find out what people are thinking.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I hope you'll tell us what they are. We'd love to know.
What'd you say, the little town?
No, I said I hope you'll tell us what you find out.
Oh, what I find out, absolutely.
Yeah.
I will do that.
That can be your next book.
All right, thanks, Sarah. Thanks, everyone,
for
tuning in. We'll see you back Sunday, 3 p.m. EST, the morning after. See you soon.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.